This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. The great state of Wisconsin is home to the only master cheesemaking program outside of Switzerland. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Luke Boland. We'll talk to Luke, of course, about wine, Psalms, and we'll talk to him about Crown Shy. We were going to taste a Chenin Blanc for our weekly wine sip, but Luke screwed up, so we're pivoting to a Pinot Gris, very interesting, which Luke and I will taste during the show and talk to you at the end of the show during the weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Luke Boland has come through some of the most celebrated dining rooms in New York, working with Vitaly Bastianich and the Major Food Group at destinations including The Grill and Del Posto, to name a few. Luke is an award-winning sommelier and beverage professional with a keen eye towards the business of wine. He's now the wine director at what is arguably the hottest restaurant in New York City right now, Crown Shy, which is downtown in the Financial District. Luke, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Great to have you here. All right, so you've been around, but let's tell everybody who you are. So give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to Crown Shy.
So I grew up in a small kind of rural town in Pennsylvania called Kennett Square. It's the mushroom capital of the world. A whole lot of stuff to do there. Yeah, I know, right? You can imagine what a bustling, happening community it was. And, you know, I kind of always had this dream that I wanted to be a chef. I started cooking when I was 16. The local restaurant was Cholula's Table. It's actually kind of a nationally recognized spot for the tasting menu that they do there. And Amy Alexi went on to work with Stephen Starr. Went to the Culinary Institute of America, and then when I moved to New York, I realized cooking professionally is really hard. So I decided...
Wait, so give me two things. You went to culinary in New Hyde Park?
Yeah, up in Hyde Park, yeah.
What year was that, and then when did you finish and come to New York? Approximately.
So that was around like 08, and I graduated my bachelor's around like 2011.
Okay.
And moved to New York around that time, pretty much right after, I think it was the summer. I first went back into the kitchen when I moved here, and then I was totally miserable, and so I decided I needed to find something else to do. So wine really just kind of fell in my lap as a more of a survival kind of instinct. It was the only other thing I knew anything about, and I just kind of threw myself headfirst into it to start learning and create a new career out of it.
Did you do any courses at CIA? There was that guy there that's been teaching forever.
Yeah, I took the intro to wine is mandatory as part of the associates. And I did okay. It wasn't really an interest of mine.
Right.
And in the bachelor's course, I took the advanced wine, not really as a particular interest, but just a minor curiosity. And so there was just scraping the surface of any sort of knowledge. It certainly wasn't something that I envisioned pursuing for a career or anything like that. It was just a course to take.
When was that wine moment? Like, when did you know this ain't bad, I could stay with it? Not necessarily at that moment, this is where I'm going to be, but I'd like to look more at this. When and how?
Yeah, I think like during Associates, we did a tasting where it was like a six wine flight of whites. And I kind of thought it was all nonsense up until then, where like people were kind of throwing out these descriptors, and I thought it was all a bunch of mumbo jumbo. And that was like the first time I think I actually got to taste like different varietals side by side and kind of have a chance to actually assess the wines and put a thought to what makes them different. So that wasn't like the aha, I could do this as a career, but this is like the this isn't all just made up kind right. of moment. For me, I mean, I worked at this store in Forest Hills called Mr. Vino's.
Decent or just package? Oh,
man, the guy that owned it was an optometrist. He didn't really know anything about wine.
Was he there or was it an investment?
No, he was. I mean, like it was literally a Cohen's Fashion Opticals next door.
His then, place?
Yeah.
And, that's funny.
Yeah, he owned like three Cohen's Fashion Opticals. The guy was a genius in terms of business. He right. knew like exactly what he was doing.
What about with wine?
Didn't know a thing about wine. Had no idea. So basically, like, you know, I think I was just 21. I had quit my restaurant job in New York. I was like on the brink, having no idea what to do with my life. And I started there as like a floor salesperson. This place, the store was like the size of the studio, you small. Know, it was small. But it was right between like the E train stop in Forest Hills at 71st Avenue and the Long Island Railroad stop. So like
it's
you
a good neighborhood, you Forest Hills.
Yeah. You couldn't not pass it on your way home from your commute. And when I started there, the manager got into an argument about like some kind of pay discrepancy thing. And so he like either quit or got fired. And so by like day three, I was the manager of the store.
Really?
like first week on the job.
Sounds like it makes sense.
Because right? this guy was like, well, I don't know anything about wine. Do you know anything about wine? And I was like, oh, not really. But
you're like Mr. Vino the second.
Right? He was like, I'll learn, you know, I'll figure it out. I don't know.
And how long is something? Is it months or are you there for like over a year?
I think I was there for just over a year.
Okay.
And when I was there, I started going through like the quartermaster stuff. I got my intro. And then I think when I started going for my certified, the owner started getting a little wary because I started talking about like service and stuff like that. Mm. And obviously, you don't really have to do service in a retail store. And I don't know, when I passed service, he kind of got a little, like, prickly about my wine pursuits, and I think, you know, he had very local aspirations in terms of, like, owning the neighborhood, and I kind of wanted to do something a little bit broader than that, and it kind of just, like, came to a head. So eventually, like, I left to go work at Megu, which...
cool place.
Yeah. It was the
more
one...
cocktails than wine there, right?
Well, there's a... There was no really rhyme or reason in terms of what sold at that place.
Right.
And I was only there for about 3 months because when I first started, the wine director quit about a month in. I didn't get promoted to the wine director, but I just decided it wasn't really the right place. I got a job at Eataly. And that was the first time where like it kind of actually felt like a serious thing where there's people that cared, you know, everywhere
this
else.
This is on 23rd Street, right?
Yeah, the one in Flatiron.
And where? At the wine store or one of the restaurants?
No, at Monzo.
At Monzo, okay.
Yeah.
Was that the meat place?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was the first time, like, so Dan Amatuzzi was the, he was like the wine director for the building at the time. But he was a guy that he was very laid back, but he cared, you know, and I think like the problem in the past was like, Dan, you would talk to him and you knew that he knew what he was talking about and he had a good grasp of what was going on. You know, people in the past like didn't really seem to have that same sort of like foundation, that same sort of like groundedness. And so that was the first time I really worked for somebody that like had a good head on their shoulders. And it was like
that wasn't an optometrist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
So now you're getting a little deeper into the real wine world.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Progress.
So what happened?
So, you know, I think it was about like, I worked there for around 6 months or so, and I started to get a little bored. So I kind of just like retooled the whole cocktail program. It just felt a little stagnant, and I started reading the PDT cocktail book. And so I kind of got curious about like making my own like bitters and other bar mixers and stuff like that. And really just more as for like a way to pass the time and you know, make the days kind of go by with an interesting task. I started redoing the whole cocktail list. And I think, you know, he kind of saw that I wasn't really content to just like sit on my laurels. So after a little bit, he asked me if I wanted to go work at Del Posto because a job had opened there.
Wow,
as like as a wine runner.
Huge leap.
Yeah, I mean,
even as a wine runner.
Yeah, he worked there. Oh, he worked in the B&B family back in the day. I think he started at Babbo as like a glass polisher, if I remember correctly. Okay. Yeah, so the real glory jobs, you know?
Right.
Someone's got to do them. And so for me, like the whole idea of just working in a 4-star New York Times restaurant was like, I'll do anything.
So you were aware of the stature of Del Posto?
Yeah, absolutely. I went there. I think it was my friend's 21st birthday. I went there when I was still at CIA. We took a train down.
Right.
And a friend of my brother's was a captain there, and he took care of us, and it was a fantastic meal. So I had been there before.
Felt good.
Yeah, you know, it was a super elegant service. Like,
yeah.
And especially at that age, you have no idea what the hell fine dining even is. You know?
Wait till you get the check. Right?
Yeah.
It's not
a
cheap place.
Yeah, you learn very quickly. Yeah. The price of knowing people.
So how long are you there? You obviously, you know, go up the ladder.
Yeah, Del Posto was like 4.5 years. That was a long time. And
did you work with Jeff?
Jeff Porter?
Porter.
Yeah.
He was there.
Oh, man. Jeff is the best.
Yeah.
Jeff is like the...
Good guy to hook in with.
Good guy to hook in with. One of the most like enthusiastic, passionate kind of advocates for Italian wine I think I've ever met. He goes gung ho in terms of, fostering the people that work for him. And he's a great guy. Cause like especially at the time, Eric Hastings, who now lives in Texas, was working with us, and Jeff was there too. So they were both going for the masters. And so I was kind of keen on going for my advanced with the quartermasters. And so these guys were doing a lot of like blind tasting groups, stuff like that. Like I got to jump into all these things where, you know, if you were just kind of on your own working in a smaller program,
never exposed to that.
Yeah. Right. Or you'd have to work so hard to find those connections. And it was just like dropped into my lap of getting to hop in.
So that's learning a lot quickly from good people.
100%.
That's what's great about New York and knowing guys like that. So it's fair to say Jeff had an impact, wine-wise, a little on who you are today?
Yeah, of course. And like for him, I think the amazing thing about Jeff is that, you know, you're working in a program like Del Posto. It's like a $3 million wine cellar. You got like, you know, 3 to 3,500 selections at any given moment, depending on what's in stock. And at the end of the day, the guy's like super happy to just talk to you about like a $60 bottle of Chianti, you know, and like
he's moved by that as much as an expensive Mascarello or whatever.
100%.
It's nice.
And he knows how to really kind of dive into those wines with the exact same passion. You know, anyone can talk about the blue chip benchmark producers because we all kind of know it. You know, like
it's a good point.
Yeah, you get to a point where it's like, you know, the great vintages, you know, the great producers, you know, the great regions. It almost becomes like an old hat, you know.
Right.
And for him, he was always invigorated by like the new up and comers. He was invigorated by the disenfranchised regions that kind of got the butt end of the stick, just like historically. And
stop for a second. To him, then, what was a disenfranchised region?
Well, then? I mean, like Chianti Classico, I think, like 100%, you know, and
right.
You see that.
But now it's great value and it's Tuscan, you know.
Yeah, but I mean,
he advocated for stuff like
that. Of course. Yeah. Well, like, why do you think there's such a resurgence for Chianti Classico? You know, it's like...
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to have somebody that's speaking on their behalf.
So you're there 4.5 years. Obviously, you ascend to like a full-blown somm.
Yeah, I kind of worked my way up to like somm and kind of like a head somm role at the end. But then they kind of tapped me to open La Serena as the wine director.
What year was that? Not that long ago.
Let's see here. I would say
3 years
four, ago? Yeah, maybe three or four years ago. Because I was at La Serena for about a year to a year and a half, and then that's when I moved to the Grill. It's probably there for about the same sort of duration.
So La Serena's same people as Del Posto. Yep. You go there to open it up in the Maritime Hotel.
Yep.
After about a year or so, you leave to go to the Grill. Why?
For me, you know, at that point, I had worked with almost exclusively Italian wine for, you know, almost 6 years at that point. I was still pretty gung-ho about passing the Master Sommelier exam.
So all along, you're studying for certifications and all that.
Yeah, and at that point, I think by the time I'd left La Serena, I sat for Master's Theory once. I didn't pass, and, you know, I felt like I didn't really have the foundation. Like, it's always a different story of, like, trying to go out and taste these wines on your own or going to like the walk around tastings that are facilitated in New York versus really having the command of a wine list that has like vintage depth and producer variation. And it's just a different story. And so you hear about the Grill opening up with this massive kind of ambitious wine program. And it was extremely tempting to finally get my hands on Burgundy and Bordeaux and Rhone and like even...
That's their wheelhouse, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And it was... France was a place that, you know, you always love, but you don't really get to work in a program with that kind of depth always. And I just couldn't help but want to jump into that.
So how long were you there?
Probably the same duration, probably like a year and a half.
And did it live up to the hype? Were you exposed to the wines, tasting, clientele, the cellar?
Absolutely.
All of that stuff. Were you advanced at that point and you were toying with the idea of going for the MS?
Yeah, I was advanced at that point. I think when I started there, I'd sat for MS once. Honestly, it was really like the most kind of like a in-depth job interview I've ever really had. I hopped on a phone call with the wine director, John Slover, and he kind of like put me through the ringer on the phone and really asking questions that kind of felt like an exam setting. Yeah. Which I was not very used to, you know, and I certainly don't have that interview style. Kind of just like just ask questions about what people like to drink and stuff like that.
Is he still there?
Well, he's the corporate beverage director for Major Food Group.
Okay. Yeah.
But like, you know, you show up there and it makes sense. I mean, like, there was lunches where Pierre Lertan from Chateau de Chem was there tasting with one of the largest collectors of the wine outside the estate. And they're bickering about whether like 1921 or like 1945 shit, right? Is their favorite vintage, you know, and you're just like...
You're in like, the middle.
Well, like, yeah, like, well, just to go open both. And you're like...
That's crazy.
Okay.
So that's certainly a fulfilling and interesting thing, but you eventually leave there and you go to Crown Shy, which is a relatively new restaurant. Just give me the transition out of there and to Crown Shy. We'll talk to Crown Shy about Crown Shy later, but
yeah.
But why do you get out? Why Crown Shy? How does that come up?
Well, Jeff Katz is a partner at Crown Shy, and he was the general manager at Del Posto back in the day.
You had that past connection.
Yeah, so we had worked together for a long time. You know, he was also, I think he was like a partner at La Serena. But he approached me to go and be the wine director. And at first I wasn't quite sure. And then like the springtime came around and I don't know if you've been in the space down at Crown Shy.
Not yet, but I heard it's amazing.
So, well, it's down at 70 Pine Street. And within the building, there's a second restaurant that's being opened on the 63rd floor.
You guys, though.
Yeah. Yeah, still us. And like when he basically introduced me to James Kent, who's the chef, and this amazing guy, Dan Catanella, who's like kind of this director of ops role. He does everything. He works his ass off. He's just this awesome dude. he brought me up to the 63rd floor, and there's this massive outdoor terrace that like looks over the west side of the Hudson River and stuff. And it's like this beautiful, like early spring afternoon, the sun's like cresting in the sky, and they're all just sitting out on this terrace in like beach chairs, drinking a bottle of white wine.
It's like going to buy a house and they're baking cookies. They set you up at the they bring you there for like the perfect scenario.
Right? Yeah. He's like, so you want to be a part of this?
What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I was like, yeah, I can see myself here.
So that worked out pretty well. So that was when? That was less than a year ago, right?
A little more than a year ago.
It is a little more than a year?
Yeah, because at first, that must have been around like May of last year. Because
when did they open?
We didn't open until March of this year.
Okay. So that's what I meant. I mean, the actual service hasn't been that long.
But okay.
The plans,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah, it's been about 6 months that we've been open.
So we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I want to get your take on a bunch of things. I've had a lot of good psalms pass through the show, obviously, winemakers, writers, and all of that. But I think you're in the position to answer this question. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe not. Tell me what you think the role of the current day psalm is. Because a lot of guys were around that are older and they've moved on to different things, you know, making wine, other businesses and all that.
Yeah.
There's sort of a new guard of guys in. I mean, how do you see the role of a psalm?
I mean, to me, the thing that is always the most important is like to never forget that you're a service individual. You know, like I think a thing that always irks me is like sometimes you hear people throw on the term like a glorified busboy and stuff like that. And it's always just like, shut the hell up, man. Like, that's all you're ever going to be, because that's what our job is. Because like facilitating whatever needs to be done in the dining room is like the name of the game, you know?
That's primary.
Yeah, of course. Like, we are so fortunate to be able to, like, have a depth of knowledge about wine that allows us to do a job that's more intricate than, like, you know, what's the typical call of a restaurant employee, you know, and facilitating these sales and opening bottles and getting to taste these amazing things. Like, God forbid the least of your duties is, like, pour some water and clear some plates and run some food, you know? It's like...
But you know not everybody thinks that way.
Yeah, I know.
You know, there's sort of this elitist tinge in thinking towards psalms. You know, so the current day psalm, at least the way you see it, is a guy who's involved, you know, in everything, the good of the restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, and...
But let's get to the wine part, because I picked up somewhere you said that psalms are in the business of high-speed data crunching, which I guess is the intake of information and all that.
For sure.
How does that apply to wine? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, you're essentially, you're an active translator, you know? Like, if you ever watch a video of, like, somebody translating, like, you know, Spanish or German or Italian or Mandarin or whatever to English, like, you're essentially just sitting there having to filter all these inputs into something that means something. And it's tough, right? Because, like, you might have some people that are, I don't know, let's say, like, fluent in wine. You know, they have a very deep understanding of producers and regions and vintages and styles, et cetera. And so it's easy. You know, that's an easy job. Listening to them and finding a bottle that's going to work for them is not that challenging. But you have people that are kind of throwing out, like, arbitrary terms. You know, not that dry, but fruity, but, like, light, but I like Cabernet, like all these.
So you got to crunch all that and try to get to the.
Yeah. You got a lot of kind of potentially conflicting data or just like stuff that's not really clear, and you kind of have to know how to like poke and prod a little bit without being annoying, without asking them questions that are hard. You know.
Well, my next question was, you know, if a guy can lead you, and even if he's all over the place.
Yeah.
Like you say, you could crunch it down to something.
Yeah.
What about the guy who, like, deer in the headlights, which is always a big sign? You know, I look at the wine list or the psalm comes over, I'm intimidated. Yeah, how do you handle that?
The people that don't know anything, you kind of, like, rather than, let's say I ask you a question, you know, what type of wine do you normally enjoy?
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, like, you know, do you like fruity wine? Yeah.
So you'll keep, like, pushing.
Yeah, you start to like kind of take their hand, you know, like, do you like it like kind of rich and like flavorful, you know, like you don't even bother about like questions where it's like, you know, do you like structured or like...
Right. So you're sensitive to attitude and not being like too nerdy.
Yeah, 100%.
Because you'll lose the guy, right?
Yeah. And you know, like you kind of have to simplify things a bit. You know, do you like big flavors? Do you like it to be like robust and like...
Right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff where they at least have an idea of like what they might like, whether or not they can put it into their own words.
So I beg our listeners, you know, just talk and be as descriptive as you can. I mean that's what you're all about. I mean you'll figure that out with basic information, but you know if you're bullshitting or you're not talking, how do you figure it out? You know, and it becomes a better experience. True.
The worst, the absolute worst, is when you try to just toss out as many like words as you've heard or as you think you should be saying.
This is the customer.
Yeah.
Just to try to be verbose or something.
The way to make our job as a sommelier to get us something that you're gonna like the hardest is just throw out a whole bunch of stuff. Like I had a person one time ask for like, you know, a dry but not too dry Sancerre from California because they typically like Cabernet Sauvignon. And you're just like,
what are you drinking Sancerre from California anyway? And then equating it to Cab. Get out of here.
And it's just like, well, like, damn, that just like, that makes my response really hard because you got to sit there for a second and be like, so do you like a light or a full bodied red? You
know? Right. Where am I going with this?
Yeah.
What, when you jumped in the biz and you know, you were exposed to some pretty good places, good clientele, good wine lists. I mean, today, have you seen much change in that span that you've worked? I mean, is there anything you put your finger on? Like, man, today is so much different than earlier because?
I think that the one thing I'll say is the customers that know what they want or the wine drinkers that know what they want are... They're stuck in their ways, is what I've found. You know, the people that are Burgundy drinkers are always going to drink Burgundy. The people that drink Bordeaux are always going to drink Bordeaux. But the refreshing part of the industry and of the business as a buyer is there's like so much more excitement for kind of everything. You know, people are much more willing to accept the fact that there's high quality wine made in different places. And so as a buyer, you can kind of be a little bit more experimental. You can buy stuff from, you know, more regions than New World that other people might have just ignored, right. Like, right. Altogether. I have people asking for orange wine oftentimes. You know, these kind that, of...
That's me. I mean, I'll walk in, you'll come over, I'll say, what's the most interesting, funky thing you have on the list?
Yeah.
And that takes... I mean, your wine list is 50-plus pages, you know, pretty traditional.
Yeah.
But that takes you off, you know, the main thing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have
More people are doing that.
Yeah, and I think that word funky, you know, a lot of people have kind of attached onto that to be their kind of like guiding light for I want something that's, you know, interesting. And, you know, sure, my list, for example, has a lot of traditional stuff, but, you know, that, like there's always like pockets and gems and like stuff from... You know, Anjou in the Loire Valley, right. Or like the Jura in France, or I mean, even like natural winemakers in Schwartland in South Africa, or like the Adelaide Hills in Australia, or like you got these like old vine Sansot producers in Chile. Like, they like
people have no clue about some of those areas.
100%. And I think that's like a travesty, you know, is people associate like natural wine, organic wine, funky wine with like, you know, some slightly esoteric regions of France, and like that's kind of it. And that exists everywhere.
Right.
You know,
I agree with that. You know, you sort of give a crap about, you know, the business and wine as a business. You know, great restaurants now rely on their wine program to turn in a lot of, you know, profit.
Yeah.
And dough and all of that. I mean, in your mind or your description, what does it take to build a successful wine program? And you had your hand in that. You know, in Crown Shy.
Yeah, I think the hardest hurdle to get over is the grasp of the financial operators on the restaurant as a whole. because it's very easy to just say, if we lower our cost percentage, then we'll make more money, right? That's like a very, it's very obvious. By
selling more wine?
By making better margins on the wine that you sell, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's just natural. You lower the cost percentage, you make more money on each bottle that you sell. Therefore, we make more money and the restaurant will be successful. The problem is you have so many platforms these days. You got like 750, you got like the Vivino app, you got like all these wine writers that are talking about what things cost. A lot of people know what stuff is supposed to cost these days. And so as a wine buyer and as a wine director, you kind of have to work a little bit harder to create like a diversified list that actually has different price points and different markups, where you can't just like that
tap everything up 2.5, 3.5, 4 times.
Whatever. Yeah. You know, I use the term like lazy wine director, where it's like, okay, well, I was told I have to hit 29% cost and therefore everything is marked up 29% cost.
That's bull. You know? You're saying that by bringing in different wines.
And by like just making decisions, you know, it's like, okay, so let's say I find really great wines by the glass that are at a good cost, and I can use that to leverage champagne. So like, for example, I think champagne is a great example where everybody loves to talk about drinking champagne. I love champagne. It's the most versatile wine. Like, you talk to Somms, it goes with everything. It's like you can pair champagne with an entire 8-course menu because it's so versatile. And then you look at their wine list and it's like, there's not a single bottle under $100, you know? So like that to me, there's like a kind of cognitive dissonance where it's like, I'm going to encourage the purchase of this wine that I'm actively making inaccessible. And that's kind of silly, yeah. You know? So to me, like pretty much all my sparkling wine is 2x markup. So it's like
retail pricing. Sparkling non-champagne?
I think like my Prosecco is 3x.
but the sparkling champagne, the champagne is.
Yeah. All like so champagne and even so like.
First of all, you have a pretty decent size list of champagne.
Yeah.
And you're saying that the markups are very reasonable.
Yeah, a lot so of the prices. So
that's a great place to drink champagne. You want to encourage that.
100%.
There's a bingo right there about, you know.
Well, a lot of the prices look like retail prices for the champagne on my list, you know, and it's right. Like...
But nobody's stopping at one bottle of champagne, so that's a good entree, right?
Yeah, see, there Hello. You go. You took the words right out of my mouth. So here's the thing, like, the person, the guest that wins is the two top that orders one bottle of champagne and leaves. You guys won, you know? Right,
you got the best value of the night.
Way to go, you did it.
Right.
You know, but like,
follow them out and rough them up, right?
you missed the $100 Somm fee. But you know, you get like a 4-top, a 6-top, anything bigger than that. And you know, they're going to have the bottle of champagne. Like I always kind of joke where I'm like, you know, if somebody has to decide between a round of cocktails or a bottle of champagne, the bottle of champagne is the obvious value. I'm doing something right. And so like, there's also the mentality, you know, if the champagne is marked up well, then probably the other stuff is too, right? And then you flip through the list.
See
and
what
then,
I did here?
Yeah, exactly. You flip through the rest of the list and you're like, oh, wow, like all of a sudden there's stuff I can drink on every page and there's like a wide variety of producers and regions and cool things.
So it actually puts people at ease a little.
That's, I hope so.
In a way, like, you know, this is a fair, good, deep list.
Yes. And, you know, eventually it gets to a point where, you know, you can talk about like the boring stuff, like cost percent.
Right.
And, or you can talk about like guest perception and repeat guests and check averages. And you can talk about like that kind of stuff where there's real numbers that go into the fact that like people that are excited to drink at your establishment, they're excited to eat at your establishment, that want to come back because they don't feel like they're getting taken advantage of, is going to create a much more sustainable business than a 29% cost of goods, you know?
You know, that sounds like a good business plan and a sustainable business plan. We got to take a break in a minute, but before we take a break, I want to get some wine intel on you from you.
Okay.
And you kind of broached it a little when you were talking about, you know, some of the off regions and all of that. But tell me personally and for business, what's, you know, exciting you as far as regions, grapes, wineries? I mean, are you keyed into anything specifically, or are you making a move at the restaurant to build up an area?
I mean, I would say, like, in terms of the bedrock of the list, I do still, like, selfishly buy a lot of French wine just because it's what I tend to like to drink. But in terms of, like, places I've been very excited by, it's pretty much, like, South America, particularly, like, southern Chile.
What's in southern Chile? That's
like, Itata Valley. Which has a lot of, like, old bush vines of different things, like Carignan, Sanso, Syrah, like, things like that.
Are they blending them, or they're doing individual grape bottlings, or both?
It's kind of a mix, but you see, like, you'll see, like, thicker skin grape varieties, like Syrah or Carignan, blended with, like, thinner skin grapes, like Sanso or Pais. So you kind of get these, like, really elegant, medium-bodied reds that have these, like, cool, spicy kind of characteristics.
Do you have a maker or two for me you could throw out?
Well, I mean, we pour one by the glass from these guys called Rogue Vine.
R-O-G-U-E?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And that is a Sanso and Pais blend. They kind of just, like, find these almost like abandoned vineyards of these bush vines. We used to have... I think the one they're pouring now is called, like, Grand Itata, and they had one called Super Itata. The one before is, like, Carignan, Syrah, and I think Mourvèdre, and the one now is Sanso and Pais. And they're just, like, awesome wines where, you know,
it's
people...
interesting.
Yeah, people think of, like, Chile, and they think of, like, Carmenere and, like, Merlot or Cab, and it's, like, very...
Where's, like,
dense.
Don Melchor from? Is that Chile? Yeah, that kind of stuff. Give me one. Kind of give me something else, too. Just like that. That was great.
Yeah, there's cool stuff in, I mean, like, South Australia. We pour a sparkling rosé by the glass from a producer named Mundara. They're in Victoria.
Spell it for me, because we post.
M-O-O-N-D-A-R-R-A.
Okay, I'll double check it.
Yeah, Mundara. It's a biodynamic grower. They cultivate cattle and they grow grapes.
So it's like a permaculture thing.
Yeah, you know, and like they, when we first opened, we had this really awesome Brut Rosé from them made in the Champagne method where they're using like a back vintage Solera Pinot Noir for their Brut Rosé. So you had this like super vinous, textural, savory, champagne style Brut Rosé for like $13 a glass.
Incredible.
You know, and it was like insane, like delicious and just like very specific into the place and like really of that Australian ethos of like that kind of Australian wine movement. And like kind of next to that, you have these producers like, you know, like Vintaloper in Clare Valley down in South Australia. And they're making, these like super taut Rieslings that are like white peppered and limey and like 10% alcohol. And it's just like piercingly fresh, you know, that kind of stuff to me is really fun. In South Africa, you got all these guys in Shortland making insane wine. And like, I love to represent these classics, like the stuff from Evan Saddy, which is like way more expensive, but you know, people have come in and recognized it and bought it, even though you're talking about like between $180 and $225 price tag for some
people are hesitant to spend that on a region that's not like a.
But when people like see, yeah, that's a wine that should be like $300
right.
on some list.
And it's not everywhere.
yeah.
It's there.
And they see it. And like, if you're in the know, or if you're like, we've had people like that have gone on vacation or honeymoon to like South Africa or are South African.
Right.
Like, they come and like, oh my God, I can't believe you have this.
Right.
And then you also have people like, you know, Three Foxes in Shortland, they're making these like really cool monovarietal vintage bottlings that change grape every year based on what was the best. Or you have people like, there's also cool influences where it's like Terre Brulé, where it's from Vincent Carême and Vouvray. He married his wife, who's South African. And when he was down there, he was like, oh my God, this terroir is amazing. And started making Chenin Blanc and Syrah and,
I mean, there's a decent there. Amount of Chenin there, but here's like a French guy who moved to South Africa, putting a nice touch on it. Those are all very interesting regions and wines. We'll post that. Luke, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about Crown Shy, the wine program, and a few other things. We're talking to Luke Boland. Luke is the wine director at Crown Shy, the restaurant downtown. I'm in New York. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that 90% of Wisconsin's milk is made into cheese? And this is not just any milk. When Swiss, German, and Italian cheesemakers first settled into Wisconsin, they chose their new home because of the special terroir of the region. Its soil and water are nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin produces 25% of all cheeses made in the U.S., and Wisconsin cheeses have won more awards than any other state or country in the world. How did they do it? Wisconsin cheesemakers combined their heritage and tradition with nonstop innovation. They were the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. Wisconsin is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of these impeccably high standards mean Wisconsin produces more than 48% of the nation's specialty cheese.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Linda Liu, and I'm the host of Feast Meets West, the show that celebrates Asian culture through the lens of food here on HRN. Listen to episodes like The Evolution of Chinatown with Numwa Tea Parlor's Wilson Tang and New York Times' Elaine Chen. Catch our ongoing series, Women in Asian Food, and spotlight episodes with our heroes like Anita Lowe. You can find Feast Meets West wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Luke Bolin. Luke is the wine director of Crown Shy. If you haven't heard about Crown Shy yet, take my word. Look for it, and you'll see that a lot of good things are going on. Luke, let's talk about Crown Shy a little.
All righty.
JonBenét, who was a past guest and a very credible wine writer, has said, "You have assembled one of the most drinkable lists in the city." How do you interpret that? I mean, I kind of get what he's saying,
yeah.
And it's a nice thing, I think. But what does he mean, or how do you translate it?
Nah, he's a super nice guy. I took care of him when he was in. He's been in like, I don't know, I would say maybe like five times
wow.
since we opened. Real just awesome dude, and always very complimentary, very kind when he comes in. I think the first time he came in, it was like a party of six. And they probably drank like seven or eight bottles of wine.
Wow.
Like, but it was so nice because you could just tell that like, there was like this fiery spirit inside of him. Where like every time he'd be like, "Yeah, let me see the wine list again." And then like, you know, there would be something else that kind of piqued his interest. And
so, what does he mean by drinkable list?
I
think. Piqued his interest, which means you were able to satiate that. But
yeah.
You know, what does that mean to not a JonBenét who walks in? Why is it a drinkable list?
Well, I think that there's to me there's like kind of two layers, right? So like in some cases you have just a good price, right? So for example, like I think in that piece he mentioned Thierry Chou, which is a producer up in Irancy, which is in northern Burgundy,
right.
And
good
you
value,
know.
Right?
Well, so we have the Cremant, which is the sparkling. And essentially, we also had in Magnum some of his Rouge wines. But basically, like, you're looking at, you know, a $35 bottle of sparkling wine on the list. Now, if you're just thinking to yourself, like, oh, that's a $35 bottle of sparkling, like, great value, you know? But, like, kind of the underlying truth there is, like, this guy also tends the vines for Vincent Dovisat up in Irancy as well. You know, one of the most iconic Chablis producers in the world, you know, second only, maybe not even second, but, like, head-to-head with Ravineau. And, like, he's the steward of his vines up in this, like, kind of outlier satellite area just outside Chablis. So, like, there's the reward for somebody that doesn't know, which is, like, delicious, inexpensive sparkling wine. And there's the reward for somebody that does know, where when you can spot that producer and be like,
it's here.
Like, obviously, right. I'm going to drink that, you know?
Right.
And like, that was kind of every single pick he had, like, throughout the night when he was just like, boom, we'll take this, we'll take that.
I think that's a good example and explanation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that applies to different producers, regions. You know, you're not just getting the, you know, the trophy guy and all that. It's wrapped around. Well, I think drinkable to him means somewhat democratic and reasonable and all of that.
Yeah, and it's not like they were only drinking, like, you know, inexpensive sparkling wine. Like,
right.
They were drinking all over the map.
Right.
But, like, that's definitely a guy that can hone in on, you know, the history of producers, and he knows what he's picking for a reason. And I think that that's kind of what he was getting at, was, like, there's value if you don't know, and there's value if you do know.
Which is almost everybody. Now, you said you were sitting on, like, the 60th floor in May or something,
yeah,
and you took the job. Does that mean you were the guy, or you had a hand in building the program from the ground up? You know, because we're talking about a new restaurant. How does, you know, we're talking incredible food. You know, we've talked about the list a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, so that first interview was kind of back in the day. And then obviously there's a lot of construction stuff that had to happen. Actually, I ended up filling back in at Del Posto during the holiday season. Because it was supposed to be open in September and Del Posto needed some. So I could just, like, walk back on the floor and, like, do that stuff again. But really, from, like, the new year on, it was just, like, crown shy all the way. And I was there full time. And, you know, it's, like, we kind of all had our tasks. And, like, we would touch base every now and again. But, like, you have such, like, amazing people there. Like, James Kent is a chef who brought in all these, like, uber talents from his history at 11 Madison and Nomad. Like, our two, like, the executive sous chef and chef de cuisine, Daniel Garcia and Jasimran Singh, are, like, crazy talented guys. And so, like, they're putting together menus. And it's, like, they, like, it doesn't need to be in anybody else's hands. You know, like,
right,
they're going to knock that out of the park regardless, you know. And then you got, like, Jeff Katz, who brought on, like, Max Quattrone, who was at Serena, and, like, at Frankie's and stuff like that back in the day, and Mary Grace Stasio, who used to be at Del Posto as a manager. And, like, so the front of the house is taken care of, too. You know, like, those right. guys know what they're doing in the front
Solid.
Of the house. Yeah, of course.
All around.
So it's great, because then, for me, it's like, sure, I like to be in tune to the food, I like to be in tune to the service, but it kind of gives me the opportunity to just be like, I don't have to worry about anything. You know, I can just focus in on the wine, and I can hire a great staff, which I think I have, and I can put together, you know, a strong by the glass list that functions the way I need it to function, and build, you know, a jumping off point to keep growing. Because,
right.
you know, this is, I'm happy with what I put together, but there's only more to do. You know, there's always more to do.
How much, you mentioned, you know, James Kent is one of the principals and the chef from 11 Madison. How much does the food, which is kind of eclectic, European, New England, California, how much does the food play on what the list looks like?
Well, I think the food is kind of fun because there's no real specific, like, defined influence. And I think, like,
It's not a blah blah restaurant.
Yeah, it's an amalgam
of a lot of things.
Yeah, and even if you try and use, like, some kind of boring term like New American, you know, like, right. that doesn't even really cover it either. And you look into the kitchen, and you see such a, like, tapestry of different people from different backgrounds and, like, different influences, and, like, they are bringing that stuff to the dishes in, like, very perceptible ways. You know, like, no kind of cultural influence is, like, stymied in the back of the house. And that, I think, really sings on the plate, you know? So it's kind of...
So the wine has to run side by side and or complement it.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of why there's such a wide gamut of different selections. And I always try to keep, like, a tight by the glass program, for instance.
And is that a big deal? I mean, you toil over that? Like, your by the glass is interesting, you know, it's great producers. That's important to you?
Well, to me, it kind of has to have twofold, right? Because, like, I think every sort of potential style needs to be covered. I think you need to have a diversity of price points. I think you have to have a diversity of styles. But I also think you need to have, and this is, you know, probably counterintuitive to a lot of people, but I think you need to have a narrow selection, you know? I think you sit down.
But narrow, but curated.
Yes, narrow as in not
going crazy.
Yeah, not a lot of selections. I like to keep it to 3 sparkling, 6 white, 1 rosé, 6 red.
Listen, you're probably right, but that's pretty decent.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you also...
I thought you were going to say 2, 4, 3, and 1 or something.
Yeah, yeah, I know. You probably got you got somebody, like, running a program with, like, one sparkling, 2
white. Well, yeah, with a 1-page wine list.
Yeah. But, you know, but here's the problem, is you go to some other places trying to do something maybe, like, maybe not more ambitious, but more creative or whatever, and, like, we have 100 wines by the glass. And then you order something like, well, we actually don't have that one stock.
Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't even want to get into it.
It's like, well, tell me about that one. Like,
you're
I have no
about
idea.
BS versus something that's very well thought out.
Yeah, 100%. Or you go to a place where it's like, let's say you have 10 whites and 10 reds, right? Yeah. Not that much more. But then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well that white is kind of like, you know, light bodied and neutral and like kind of like salty and minerally and like refreshing. But then so is that one and so is that one. And then all of a sudden you have like 3 whites that pretty much taste the same. And it's like, so you might as well just have like 7 instead of 10.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why I leave it to a guy like you. All right. Last thing on the restaurant. So the list, when we go back, I mean, I said earlier it's over 40, 50 pages. What are the distinguishable strengths? Obviously, you keep saying French. So French, but what is it? More Burgundy than Bordeaux, vice versa, you know, Northern Rhone.
It's
just tell me where that strength is and what you're proud of.
Well, in terms of like number of selections, I would say definitely Burgundy for sure. And the thing with Burgundy is I treat it very much like champagne, where it's like, you know, the prices are obviously just always climbing. And oftentimes they reach a point of like comical, just astronomical heights. And so Burgundy is a place where I try to be very like rational and reasonable with my markups, because otherwise your list just starts to look like a joke, you know.
So that's great. I mean, you know, if Burgundy is something you've started to drink or you're a drinker or you want to try it, you're going there and the list is diverse and reasonable.
Well, and it's
right?
Tough.
I mean, that's what you're saying.
Yeah. It's tough too. Like, let's say somebody comes to you and they're like, hey, you know, you should, if you want to splurge, you should really try Meursault. And you go to a restaurant and it's like current vintage Meursault. It's like 2017 Meursault. And it's like the point of entry is like $180. You're just like,
come on.
You're like, what the hell? And that's like a very sort of like reasonable expectation nowadays for like a high quality producer Meursault, is like you're not getting in for less than $150. And that kind of bothers me a little bit, where like it's the same thing with champagne. You know, champagne is the most versatile wine, blah blah blah, and then you can't buy it. And so I think like
I like that.
The strength to me is like, yes, there's a lot of selections in Burgundy, but like you see the blue chip producers, but for a fair markup, and you see up and coming producers for a fair markup. And so it's a little bit more inviting, I think. And then you also have that, and I think the strength too is diversity. Because it almost feels, in my opinion, like a retail store, like or a personal seller. You know, like I like to believe if I had a limitless amount of money and I just like had to start buying wine for myself, that the wine list that I have right now would be very reflective of what I would be buying and putting in my cellar.
Right.
And using to like entertain guests I had at my house, or to like drink with dinner.
That you wanted to do good for.
Yeah.
You know, that they'd walk out and go, this is cool, I like this, what's that?
100%.
You know, put a little pain into the fact that you want to impress them and woo them and all of that.
Yeah, and I think, like, I can really confidently say, like, there's nothing on my list that I wouldn't drink myself.
Which is great. All right, we got to move on. I'm going to subject you to our wine list, but before we do that... I can't let you leave
subjection
here without... is there anything left to say about Mario Batali? You were around that world. Do we not want to get into that?
Not really. I mean, like...
All right, let's leave it. Fine. All right. So, Luke, we do a thing called the wine list every week. We ask our guests the same 5 questions. So this isn't unique to you. It's 5 questions that the last 124 guests...
I'm still going to feel unique.
And by the way... Luke is here celebrating our 3-year anniversary, ooh, and I think it's our 125th show. So, Luke, this is a little special. We started the show 3 years ago today.
Yeah.
And you're our 125th interview. But we've been to Charleston Wine Festival many years, Taste Washington. We've been to Napa, Naples Wine Festival. We've been to a bunch of other places. All right. So, here's the wine list. The first question is, and we may have broached it a little already, but what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge, what's interesting for the restaurant, what's seasonal, what's cool?
One thing that I recently tasted was a Beaujolais from Domaine Chapelet. Is their Chiroubla.
Chiroubla's a region?
Yeah, it's one of the crews of Beaujolais. You know, I think... in an attempt to become a more serious region, you start to see some Beaujolais with, you know, like everybody used to see like carbonic maceration and like these really lifted, juicy, fruity styles across the board. And I think kind of like slung shot in the opposite direction. You see all these producers from like Morgon and Moulin Avant making these like really like tough and like, you know, kind of muscular styles. And this one is just like really true to form. It's like, It's well structured, but it's like bright and fresh and juicy without feeling fruity for no reason. And it's just a really well made wine.
So that's a Chapelet Chiroubla?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
I've been really keen on this producer in Australia, Sierra Reed.
S-I-E-R-R-A, Sierra Reed?
Yeah, R-E-D.
Okay.
Yeah, she's actually she's an expat that moved to Australia, but she's doing this really cool stuff where she's only working with like organic and biodynamic growers, typically that have centenarian vines, so like only 100-year-old vines, wow, and up. Typically dealing with people in like Barossa and Western Victoria, so people like Heathcote and Grampians and stuff like that. But she has like these really awesome wines where she's got like, you know, typically people think of Aussie Shiraz. It's like dense, tons of
big
oak,
up,
it's like 16% alcohol, yeah, and her stuff is like 60-day maceration, like Bartolo Mascarello, and like 12% alcohol, and you know, it's like translucent in the glass, and floral, and lifted, and just
sounds
like
great,
really kind of on the cusp of new Australian wine.
Those are good ones. I'm going to post those. All right, here's the goofiest question on the list. Okay. Favorite wine and food pairing? Anything, not that you eat it every week, month, year, but something that when you do, it's like, whoa, you know, this is what it's about.
I'll tell you what, the this wine pairing sticks with me like all the time. I went,
you know that if you say champagne and oysters, I smack you.
Yeah. Oh,
so you
shit,
retract
I guess
that.
I should just,
okay.
Yeah.
So give me your second choice.
I'll just leave now.
Okay.
No, I went to Lucali's a little while ago.
Okay.
And
that's a pizza place in Brooklyn, Mark,
yeah,
Iacono. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a decent pizza joint.
Okay.
Arguably, like some of the best pizza. And
for sure.
A buddy of mine brought a bottle of 2006 Chateau Fonsalette. And so this is a Grenache from the Châteauneuf-du-Pape region in the southern Rhône in France. And my God, like, just like Grenache and like tangy, tart flavors, like, you know, the pizza sauce.
On the pizzas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have like herbaceousness from the basil. You have this like tangy, tart pizza sauce and this like exotic, fruity, strawberry, like Grenache. It was just like absolutely stunningly delicious, and that is like, you know, it couldn't have been a better bottle to go with the pizza.
That's a good one, man. All right, third question, and I know you've been busy the last year, but give me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. Where's a place you can go to that you could hang and, you know, there's good people, they got a good wine list, they know what they're talking about? Wine bar, restaurant?
Yeah, I mean,
I always worry about being exclusive, like, oh, I left this guy. But who's good out there?
The two that always immediately come to mind are Caleb Ganser's program over
at
La
Show
Company.
Favorite.
Yeah, yeah. Like, how can you not pick that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like
it's a bit of an industry hang, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for the consumer, it's a knockout place. I'm a fan.
I mean, that's a great place to go. The new, like, the Frank's Wine Bar that they've tacked
John
on.
John Patterson.
Yep. He does
it's
a great job.
Guy.
But, you know, I will say something that might go a little bit overlooked. I recently went to Gotham Bar and Grill for dinner. And
Josh Litt.
Man, he's got, like, killer list and also some really fun, very inexpensively marked up wines in the back that are like more kind of like natural tuned.
So Alfred Portali just left. He took over for Heidi Turzin. They changed everything after 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
What you're talking about is that stuff Josh has sort of worked his way in?
I think it's twofold. One, I think that there's a lot of the old guard stuff that, you know, right. It's probably sat around forever.
Big time.
And so it's like just good value to be found there. And, you know, honestly, that place has always kind of gone through ebbs and flows where random times you'd be like, oh my God, I can like cherry pick their Northern Rhone selection so bad. And like then all of a sudden you'd be like, their selection sucks. And like right. You come back and you'd be like, wow, I can really cherry pick their Bordeaux. And then you come back and be like, oh, that selection sucks. And like, but now it's in this really cool place where there's just a lot of great selections. And so I wouldn't call it like, you know, like a wine bar or whatever, but just a place to go and like have wine.
I think it's a good pick. I think it's a very cool spot.
Yeah, yeah.
New chef and all that. All right, fourth question. Favorite all-time wine? I always used to say it used to be the most rare and expensive wine, but it's not that anymore. What's an important wine in your past that still resonates with you?
Hmm.
Could be one, could be two.
Yeah, that's well, I will.
So nothing like blasts in your head.
It's tough, man. You open a lot of stuff. It's hard to like pick ahas.
But any like experiential.
All right, stuff? You know what? You know what's really cool. So up at the grill, we had a 3 liter of 1934 La Mission Opryon.
Jesus.
And I think it was on the list for like $22,000 or something like that.
Okay.
I was like, ah, man, I'll never sell that. And some guy one day brought in the same bottle as a 750 for corkage. And so I was like, what the hell? Like, what are the odds that I get to try
that? That's crazy.
It's like,
so you got to taste it?
Yeah, like, who knows? You know, like it could have been fake. It could have been whatever. But like, man, that wine was like opaque, in shape, like, you know,
for
great color.
Kind of age.
Like, my goodness.
That's what's impressive. That you know, it holds up and all that. I get that. That's a good answer.
I'm willing to suspend disbelief of, like, you know, veracity or whatever to believe that that bottle was real and that it was in excellent condition because it was really quite awesome.
Right. Rudy Kernowayan
be
mixed
damned.
It in his kitchen in California with Merlot from Napa.
Yeah, it was all right. Oakville.
Right. All right, last question, and you could probably do this. Give me best wine around $15-$20 retail. Give me a white, give me a red. It could be category like Muscadet. It could be a maker. It could be a grape. I say this every show. My kids are in their 20s. They can't bring crappy wine to a party. $8, $10, $12. They can't afford 40.
Yeah.
So for $18-$20, what's interesting?
Let's see. I think on the white side, there's a producer in Austria named Hirsch.
Spell.
H-I-R-C-H. That's it. Wait, H-I-R-S-C-H.
Right, Hirsch.
Hirsch.
Right.
And they make a Grüner Veltliner called Hirschvergnügen, which literally means like essentially happy deer time.
Right.
And it's just like an inexpensive Grüner Veltliner, but it's like, you know, really just translucently varietal, typical, you know, like...
That's a great... You know, Grüner's a great value. You're giving us a good maker.
Yeah.
Covered the white. Red always is a little harder, but what do you got?
You know, the red, I think I would probably go back to that that Vincent Carême project in Schwartland.
Okay.
It's called Terre Brûlée.
Spell T-E-R-R-A.
T-E-R-R-E.
E, Terre.
B-R-U-L-E-E. The first E has
like
the...
Like creme brûlée?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It, like literally scorched earth. You know, the Schwartland is like that granitic, like black mountain, so it looks like burnt land. But he does a Shiraz and Sanseau blend.
In that price range?
Yeah, yeah. I imagine it'd be on the shelves for probably like $12 to $15.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a great, interesting wine.
It's juicy, but it's not like dense and like chewy, but it has like good fruit, but lifted kind of like floral characteristics and spice. And it's like it's a fun kind of example of South African red wine.
All right. So, Luke, I don't say this often, but that's how you answer that question with two good recos. All right. We got to wrap up in a few minutes. Every week at the end of the show, we taste a different wine on air. I asked Luke to bring a wine in. He effed that up, but I'm not mad at him. because he's a good guy. But we did, Luke and I,
on the sea train.
Luke and I strategized, and we pulled a bottle out of Roberta's, which has a wonderful list. And Luke decided that we pull a Pinot Gris. Let's talk quickly about the wine. What'd we pick and why?
Well, so, I mean, what caught my eye is, you know, first and foremost, I'm always looking for the producer. And this is from Irie, who's a producer out in Oregon.
E-Y-R-I-E.
Yes.
Irie.
Yep. And really cool stuff coming out of here. They have some of the oldest Pinot Gris vines in the United States. They have some of the only non-phylloxera-affected vines for Pinot Gris and for Pinot Noir. So, you know, if you're unfamiliar, phylloxera, this root louse that decimated tons of vines in Europe and the United States, et cetera, et cetera. But you have this like really old, healthy rootstock. And so Pinot Gris, you know, oftentimes people think like Pinot Grigio, this like kind of innocuous, whatever, Italian wine. And really it's kind of more than that. And I think this wine
grows well up in Oregon, right?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, right. And in Oregon, you get a much more textural representation, where you're getting more kind of like stone fruit, like peach and apricot.
Well, let's evaluate it. Let's All get right. specific. So let's start with color. It's got a beautiful, like almost golden orange.
Yeah, you'll notice oftentimes Pinot Gris will have this like kind of copperish hue to it.
Copper is good.
Yeah,
copper.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful color. So it's nice. It's not pale. Let's go nose. Give me your nose descriptors.
Well, the nose to me, there's two things to it. One, you know, this is a four-year-old white wine, but even still, there's a little bit of that kind of reduction to it. So you get some smoky, flinty notes right off the bat. But like after that, you get past that into kind of apricot and peach and stone fruit notes. You get this like kind of nutty almond sort of characteristic.
That's the reduction part, you think, or the oxidative?
The reduction is going to be more the smoky stuff, like matchstick, flinty, those kind of things.
Got it. What about mouthfeel? It's pretty full-bodied. You know, it's a medium. Leaning towards medium plus, right? For a Pinot Gris.
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely like a medium plus kind of white wine.
A little acidity on the tongue, right?
Yeah, it's textural, it's mouthwatering, but what I like about it is you kind of get that good balance where you have like kind of lemon pith, like that mouthwatering acidity, but then you also have this like really succulent stone fruit, orchard fruit kind of characteristic. Super generous in terms of the fruit profile. And I even like that kind of bitterness, like on the back of the tongue.
I don't mind that.
That to me is very reminiscent of like the Italian examples, you know. And if you're thinking of like the Friulian styles of Pinot Grigio, you'd have like Prosciutto di San Daniele with that kind of stuff.
It would hold up to it well.
I think that'd be right at home.
What about the palate? Does the palate match the nose? When we drank it early on in the show, I hate to say it, but I got hit with apple.
Okay.
That went away, but
what
do we get on the palate?
Yeah, I think like here, fleshier fruits kind of come forward a little bit. And I do like that it still maintains that kind of like citric and malic like tartness. I think the wine would feel flabby or fat, you know, if it didn't have that kind of punchy acidity to keep everything intact. To me, I think this is like pretty textbook. I really like the sort of floral characteristics. Like you get a lot of orange blossom and like citrus blossom
notes.
Beautiful
wine. I mean, it's pretty complex. Ballpark to your best call retail?
Retail, I'd put this in like the $35 price point.
And it's a special bottle for $35, which is not cheap, but I mean, this is top of the game for this varietal and all of that. What would we pair this with?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I was actually thinking like when you said, you know, not cheap, like we're kind of moving into the fall season, you know? So if you're thinking more of like kind of rustic cooking, if you're thinking things at home, like stews or like polenta or like things like that, they're kind of like heartier and more rib sticking, like this is going to go with any of that, you know.
Up
in Friuli they cook a lot of like rabbit and game and things like that.
Not the body, the acidity.
You're cooking like rabbit and game at home all the time, but
well, I go in the backyard, I snag a rabbit and you know, I just skin it make rabbit, a little rabbit stew
is my favorite thing to do.
Like the next couple days I eat leftovers.
Yeah, but it's all good. Yeah, you know, like I think now particularly in the autumnal season, if you're talking like
it's a
squash, apples, pears, acorns.
But a lot of
nuts.
People think you shift to red. This is a white matches, to your point, with some good autumnal fare and all that.
It's a great transition white.
All right, Luke, that was a good pick. We got to wrap the show up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast. on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook. We're at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at me, S. Ben Ruby, and the hashtag Instagram. On Twitter, to confuse you more, we're at Ben Ruby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. Like I said during the show, we'll post Luke's wine list with all the answers and makers, and I'll give you more info on the weekly wine sip, the Irie Pinot Gris we tasted. Luke, if we want to find out more about you on social media and Crown Shy, two separate things, where do we go?
Hell, I'm really bad at the old.
All right, so you can find Luke on Instagram at lbolin22.
There you go.
Okay,
I'm
Twitter. Crown Shy is at Crown Shy New York City. All right, why did I bring this guy in?
but
those are the two important things.
Yeah, lbolin22, that's me.
I said that.
Yeah.
And Crown Shy New York City, NYC.
Yeah. There you go.
Those are the places to find it. The reason I brought Luke on is, you know, Luke's got a great background and an eye towards wine and the business. And Crown Shy, like I said, is arguably, you know, one of the great and hot spots in New York right now. Luke talked about a little of the dedication, you know, of the sous chef and the chef de cuisine and James Ken and the front room and the back room. And you'll feel that when you go there. So I want to thank our guest, Luke Bolin. I want to thank our engineer, as always, Jeet, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.